Thank you, Professor Eifert, and thank you, the High Association, for inviting me to be here with you. I must say, I've had only a very brief acquaintance with the Baha'i community through my work at the United Nations, where you know you have a very active and very highly regarded liaison office. I've had the chance and the privilege of participating in a few of their meetings at the UN. But I find, even in this brief acquaintance, that the goals that you pursue, the aims that you have, are very much in tune with the ideals I have, with the dreams I have, and so that when I am with you, I feel less alone. Because very often, moving in international circles, people are very much stuck in the status quo, very much stuck in trying to preserve what there is, and afraid to look ahead. And even if they see ahead, they pretend that there is nothing wrong. Yet there is plenty that there is wrong, and there's plenty that we can do about it. And I think your community, worldwide, and wherever it exists, is one of the few groups of people who represent the positive signs which can move us from one age into the next. Now, I cannot pretend to put what I have in mind into the context of your thinking. I don't know enough about it. But I would like, anyway, to begin with a few passages which struck me as being particularly relevant to the kind of concerns, very deep concerns that I have, which I would like to share with you. So let me first of all just read to you some passages that you must know by heart, but let me just try to recall this as a preface, as an overall framework for what I would like to say. In that little leaflet, that one page that has been distributed in your registration package, there is the following statement, and I will read just a few sentences from it. It talks about the principle of oneness. And it says that this principle of oneness implies an organic change in the structure of present-day society, a change such as the world has not yet experienced. It calls it the consummation of human evolution, an evolution that has had its earliest beginnings in the birth of family life, its subsequent development in the achievement of tribal solidarity, leading in turn to the constitution of the city-state and expanding later into the institution of independent and sovereign nations. This process, it is said, is not only necessary, but inevitable, and that its realization is fast approaching. Let me not read any further, since it's there behind, in front of you, and you know it, this text, much more than I do. However, these couple of ideas have struck me very deeply. Let me supplement this with a quotation, likewise from Shoghi Effendi, that is given in the booklet of, in a monograph of Dr. Danish on the violence-free society. And he quotes Shoghi Effendi, and let me just read that two sentences for you also. The long ages of infancy and childhood through which the human race had to pass have receded into the background. Humanity is now experiencing the commotions invariably associated with the most turbulent stage of its evolution, the stage of adolescence, when the impetuosity of youth and its vehemence reach their climax and must gradually be superseded by the calmness, the wisdom, and the maturity that characterize the stage of manhood. It is my dream and my hope that we can work and eventually achieve this stage of manhood, stage of humanhood, which will be calm and peaceful and unite all of the peoples of the earth in a global family. But I want to underline to you, and this is what my talk is going to be about, this phrase within this remarkable sentence, that we are now experiencing the most turbulent stage of human evolution. It is true, and I'm afraid it will become more and more true in the next 10 years or 15 years. From all the evidence that I have, from all the international documents, all the plans, all the strategies that I have seen in the UN and outside, I cannot avoid the conclusion that the present system, and I'm talking about the international socio-economic, technical, industrial system, this system is heading into a crisis toward a watershed that there is no turning back. But I don't want to preach doomsday. When I say this, I don't mean that this is the end of the road. What I mean to say is that this is the end of an age. And I hope that this is the end of the age of adolescence. And it could be the beginning of the age of manhood. But for that we have to act. And we have to act already. Because if there is one, only one word with which, about which I would express some doubt, is that this one word of inevitable, of inevitably reaching the next stage. Perhaps when these words were written, the tremendous powers that humankind has unleashed were not known, could not have been known. It could not have been known that now we can kill ourselves off and all other species in the world with a push of a few buttons. It is not known, it was not known, but that we now know that we can practically destroy the life support systems of this earth, of this planet, which is our habitat, which is our home. So what I want to impress on you is not to put blind faith into the coming of the next age, but to work for it. Because there is an alternative, a dreadful alternative, that we won't make it. However, I want to point out to you what we might expect as we move toward the 1990s and into the 1990s, and what choices we have to make, what prospects we will face. Because we are not heading toward an epoch which is predetermined. We are not destined either one way or another. I believe we have choices, and the choices will be increasingly up to us to make. This is my main thing. The choices will be able to be exercised at a time when the present system, this age of adolescence, crumbles around us, as I believe it will. Now, this fact that we can make a choice in the midst of a crisis, this fact is not only a hunch. It is now a well-documented, well-established scientific insight applying to biology, applying to physical and chemical systems, applying to the evolution of the universe as a whole. I will not want to give you here a lecture on the theories of change and evolution. Just want to remind you of a few things. The idea that evolution is smooth and it's gradual has by and large been abandoned even in the life sciences. Very recently, only as of about 1980, that this turnabout has occurred. The idea that natura non facit saltum, that nature does not make leaps, which was a main tenet of Darwin, has gone out the window. In fact, now we talk about punctuated equilibrium or saltatory versions of the Darwinist thesis. In other words, that when evolution occurs, macroevolution, the creation of a new species, and we in society also we are talking in a sense about the creation of a new species, this comes about when the existing dominant species becomes destabilized, and then a small, up till then almost dormant or peripheral species can all of a sudden come, spread, and take over. Make the analogy even with the Baha'i group. There will come a time, and I'm convinced it will be before the end of this century, when the dominant systems, institutions of today, will crumble, when those peripheral movements that are today suppressed and persecuted will have their day. And we must hope that there are movements such as yours which will carry the day and not inhuman and dictatorial and terrorist type of movements. And this is why we must prepare already. In another facet, coming from systems theory, since your chairman has mentioned that I was interested in this area and I've written a number of books on that, we likewise have come to the conclusion that no system evolves in the absence of what is termed a fluctuation, a very major fluctuation, sometimes called a mega fluctuation, this fluctuation, which comes either from the environment or is generated by the system, must destabilize the existing corrective, self-stabilizing mechanisms of that system, so that the system then can move into a new mode, into a new kind of existence, into a so-called new dynamic regime. Again, I won't enlarge on this. If you have questions about it, I'll be glad to reply to them. But the evidence that this is occurring in the universe at large, that this can be reproduced in the laboratory, this is increasing. Again, since the mid-70s, the laboratory experiments have been coming one after another. In the late 70s, a Nobel Prize was given for the discovery to Ilya Prigozhin. We are now facing a new shift in our ways of thinking about change. Change is not smooth. It's not gradual. It's sudden. It moves through crisis. It can be catastrophic, but it can move to us also to the next plateau, the next level of evolution. And it must be our hope that change applied to human society will not be catastrophic, but will move us to that next plateau, which represents the maturity of our species. Let me move to a little bit more empirical facet. So let me tell you why I believe that we are approaching such a watershed. We have had in this epoch, in this century, periods of war, periods of a financial collapse. We also had epochs of progress, of cooperation, and of stability. But if we are to draw a balance sheet, we would find that the troubled periods are accelerating, the instabilities are mounting, and if the trends continue, we may reach the point of no return. We might be reaching a series of interconnected crises in which one thing feeds into another, which no Marshall Plan, no Apollo mission, no effort made by the present administrative and political systems could be of help, could prevent from occurring. The stakes are now, of course, the highest that we have ever confronted. We have now 4.555 billion people. By 1990, we will have 5 billion. By the year 2000, we should have 6.5 billion people, according to median projections of the UN. We are at the present time concerned that the extra pressures put up by these many people in a tribally oriented society, global society, by that I mean nation states that are inward looking, that are holding on to the sovereignty as though it was God given, as though nothing else existed, that talk about interdependence but fear their neighbors and try only to relate to one another to their own advantage, that in this epoch we may find ourselves in a situation of a breakdown. We are fearing that this would lead to a war, to a confrontation in which nuclear arms would be used. This is a possibility. But I want to emphasize to you, although it may sound very heretical, that an excessive fascination almost, I'm using this almost in a clinical sense, with the nuclear specter can blind us to another factor. The factor that if we don't kill ourselves off, the continuation of the present trends will lead us into a breakdown. It's not enough to do away with nuclear arms. Of course we must do that, because the presence of nuclear arms is an ever-present danger. In this epoch, it will remain a danger in the next plateau of civilization also. But we must not be blinded by fearing the nuclear flash to the extent that we disregard the trends, the macro trends, the world problematic, which heads us straight into a situation which will be very, very difficult to master, which I think we will not be able to master with our present institutions. On the surface, let me go ahead now a little bit in time. The 1990s, I think, will be a period of mounting tensions and self-reinforcing crisis. These crises will bring about social unrest, political coups, and all that go with them. They will come about despite the affirmation of our economists, a certain breed of economists, the equilibrium economists, that all these equilibria are temporary in nature and they are self-curing, that all we have to do is let the market operate and it will take care of all our problems. This, in fact, is one of the most dangerous kind of beliefs because it encourages inaction. It says, let things go on the way they are, they'll take care of themselves. And a science of an economic recovery can give us the false sense of illusion that all things are all right. But look at the global picture. They are far from all right. We are going to have, in the last 25 years of this century, about 2.23 billion people, almost 2.25 billion new people entering the world. That's the increment in human population. According to all population projections, this is the largest increment humanity has ever had, and possibly the largest that it will ever have. Afterwards, even if we don't kill ourselves off, even if we could maintain the present system, the next increment, in the year 2000-2025, would be lesser because there wouldn't be so many young people. The age distribution would be different. These people are coming into the world in the poor areas. By the year 2000, if present trends continue, over 80% of the world population would live in what we now call the third world. The fastest population increases are occurring in the poorest regions. They would need an infusion of capital, infusion of education and skills, a creation of infrastructure and of jobs of a tremendous magnitude. We know what is needed. For example, the latest projections of the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, says we would have to quintuple, multiply by a factor of 5, investment in food production in the developing countries. Similar projections apply when you talk about health, when you talk about employment, when you talk about industrial distribution, etc. There are no signs that anything like this can happen. In fact, per capita food production has been decreasing by 10% over the last decade in Africa. It is decreasing in many countries in Asia and in Latin America. More and more countries are becoming dependent on food from the outside. And when they do so, they are becoming dependent on two things, on the availability of food and on the money with which to buy it. Now, both will be impossible to have in the coming years. Why? First of all, they get more and more indebted, these countries, so they will not have capital. They do not already have capital. They might be facing a series of bankruptcies. And secondly, the amount of food that could be traded in world markets is diminishing. The latest projections, which came to light only in some very highly qualified professional computerized studies of U.S. agriculture in a meeting of the Club of Rome about a month ago in Budapest, show that by the year 2000, the U.S. will not have any food to export due to a number of reasons: price of energy, the paving under of productive land, the erosion of topsoil, the increasing need for fertilizer and for mechanization, and so on. It is quite likely that we will not be able to feed 6.5 billion people by the turn of the century. And this is only one of the many facets of the problem. Let me give you a brief scenario of how things might go. I hope that they don't. On the other hand, in a sense, I hope that also some kind of a breakdown is coming, because I do not see a possibility of creating a new world, a better world, unless the present institutions suffer this kind of a dissolution. I don't think you can build a new world before the old one has disappeared. And now we are in a global situation, and this has to happen globally, and it probably will happen globally. Let me give you, just even if it might seem a little bit boring, on the one hand, if you're not interested in finance, if you are, it might seem too dramatic, but anyway, let me give you a little scenario. Think of it that you are now in the late 1980s. You will find that a number of Latin American countries, let's say Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Mexico, and Venezuela, cannot anymore repay their obligations. They have decided to repudiate their debts.